Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon, Rochester and the web. You are listening to Soundbites on May 5th. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Rick Harrison.
And we'll be bringing you news and all types of different views and everything else that you can do. And I won't even try to mimic what Nick does every week because there's just no way. He just has a knack for it. But with some of the news, I'll turn that on over to Steve Ray.
Yeah, well, I'm getting my camera set up here. Microsoft
multitasking.
Yeah. Microsoft hooks onto Nook. Microsoft is pledging $605 million to help bolster Barnes & Noble's Nook digital book division as the software giant wages another bet on an industry where it has lagged behind rivals, basically saying, screw you, Amazon. Editorial content by Steve Ray.
We hope so.
The deal catapults Microsoft into a high-stakes battleground whose combatants include Amazon, Apple, and Google, and gives Barnes & Noble a lifeline to continue investing in a fast-growing digital book business. As part of its investment, Microsoft is taking a 17.6% stake in a new subsidiary that will include both the e-book division and Barnes & Noble's college bookstore unit, which operates 641 stores. Shares of Barnes & Noble, which has struggled with a slide in traditional book sales and heavy investments in its Nook digital business, surged 52% on the news to $20.75, the highest closing price in about 2 years. The tie-up with Barnes & Noble also furthers Microsoft's strategy to its move beyond Windows and Office franchising in investing its growing cash pile into businesses. Had about $60 billion at the end of March that it's failed to capitalize on in recent years. Those deals have yielded mixed results. Last year, Microsoft agreed to supply the mobile operating system for smartphones sold by Nokia. Those products haven't gained a large foothold in the market. Internet partnership in 2009 with the wounded internet company Yahoo was designed to help wounded internet company. Nice prose here, Nick. An internet search partnership in 2009 with the wounded internet company Yahoo was designed to help Microsoft catch up to Google through its Bing search engine, and that hasn't gained much ground either. Last year, Microsoft also bought internet calling service Skype for $8.5 billion after Google and Facebook showed early interest. The deal was the biggest acquisition in Microsoft's history, and another payoff remains unclear. They haven't really done anything with it. Despite those efforts, years of acquisitions, Microsoft continues to generate more than 85% of its annual operating income on Windows software and services and its Office software. By taking a minority stake in the new subsidiary that will market the Nook, Microsoft gains several footholds into e-reading. For starters, Barnes & Noble is committed to creating a Nook e-reading app for Windows 8, the forthcoming Microsoft operating system that will be used on tablet-style hardware and PCs, and for smartphones powered by Microsoft software. The Nook, like Amazon's Kindle Fire, runs on Google's Android software. So that's our question to you this week. Microsoft makes a big bet on Barnes & Noble's Nook. Our choices are great idea for both companies. They'll never beat Amazon. And ebooks, just a fad. So what do you think about Microsoft taking an equity stake in Barnes & Noble? Give us a call. And that's our question to you. Our numbers are 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or 1-800-790-0465. And I'm waiting for my browser to open to tell me what our current poll count is to see how many people have answered and what their choices are. So let's look at this soundbites as we're
contacting. I guess that was a man answers hang up.
Man, that's yeah, sometimes it's tricky. Is my internet access working here? You can reach us again as I mentioned. Our phone numbers are 585-966-JAZZ. That's 585-966-5299 or toll free at 1-800-790-0465. And still waiting for my web page to come up here. Are we? Are you on the internet there, Rick?
Yeah.
Here we are. All right. So now the poll. Let's see. We have currently 29 votes, and they'll never beat Amazon is leading at 48%. A great idea for both companies is 28%, and trailing in third place, ebooks just a fad at 24%. Now, we know that just answering the poll isn't enough, so if you look at the yellow box under the poll, you can click the link and give your opinion about the poll. It's interesting to see some of the opinions are actually about the poll this week. That's always interesting to come across that. And looks like we have a phone call ready for us. Do we, Dave, there? So is Dave pushing the buttons?
Yep. We got Frank from Irondequoit. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi. My question is, can I use restore to delete a program, or do I have to use the add remove thing?
No, what you want to do is get a product called Revo Uninstaller.
Technically, you could use restore because it removes everything to the last restore point, but that includes all your documents, all the other applications, whatnot.
But the registry is still
a mess. The registry settings can still be a mess. Windows' own add remove programs doesn't work that well either. So as Dave mentioned, the best way to remove a program is the Revo Uninstaller.
Uh-huh.
And you can get that at RevoUninstaller.com, I'm pretty sure. And what that does is it removes the program and it removes all the extra crap in the registry that that most installers leave behind, and the uninstallers never remove either.
Well, my problem is I don't have internet.
Well, you have a friend with internet.
Yeah.
So you can download it on their computer, put it on a flash drive, and take it to yours.
Oh, okay.
And do it that way.
It's called Revo.
Revo Uninstaller.
How do you spell it? R-E-V-O?
Yep.
Revo Uninstaller.
Yeah. It's a very small program. They can put it on a flash drive. You bring it back to the house, install it, and that way you use that instead of all these other, Microsoft's uninstaller or the uninstaller for the program.
Yeah, even the program's own uninstaller doesn't do a very good job. And a lot of, it's not really the program's fault. It's Microsoft's fault for that giant registry mess that they've stuck us with for so long now.
Their program, their rules.
See, my problem is I bought a computer, and coming to find out, there's practically no programs on it. So if I put all these programs on and then find out I don't want them later...
Mm-hmm.
You
use the Revo, and Revo will keep the registry smaller and a lot cleaner, will run a lot smoother.
Uh-huh. Basically, how many programs can I add on a computer?
How big is the hard drive?
Yeah, thousands.
You can add quite a few?
Yeah.
How big is the hard drive?
It's 40 gig, I think. Or...
Yeah, you can install as many programs as will fit on the hard drive.
Oh, okay.
And... sounds like an older machine.
Oh, yes, yes. It's quite an old machine. And, you know, like I says, it's bare bones, practically nothing on it. It was a Sony, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I figured Sony would give me something. It's like buying a car without tires.
Well, see, the thing of it is, though, if somebody else, you know, if you've got this second hand.
No, I bought it new.
You bought it brand new, and it's only got a 40-gig hard drive on it?
I think that's what it is.
No.
I might be wrong.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no way a new machine...
It's a Vista.
That's an older machine.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
500 gig, maybe.
Yeah, 500 gig is about the smallest you'd find in any new machine. Uh-huh. Usually a terabyte or bigger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a Vista, so it's probably an older machine.
It's an old. Yeah, it's a lot older than that. And
it may have been a refurbished machine.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But again, they don't put much on it. And quite honest with you, Vista had its issues with running with other programs and getting printers to work.
Yeah, there were a lot of compatibility
issues.
Even saying that is
really?
An issue. Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of programs didn't work with it, especially Vista, scanners and printers.
I mean, Vista's right there, up there with ME and the future Windows 8.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, every other Windows is bad.
Yeah.
So 7 is good. That means 8's going to be bad.
Oh, it is. I mean, we'll go on that after we're done with this caller here. But So does that kind of answer your question?
Well, if I buy, say I decide to go for and buy a new computer, you know, how do I know what programs are on it and what I can
Generally, there are no programs on it. You buy whatever programs you want for it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Quite oftentimes, when you can buy a bundle, so you get a computer and some programs, and it usually lists that bundle in the spec list.
And, you know, if you want a word processing program and all that type of stuff, that's where we'd usually turn around and say, you know, get like OpenOffice. OpenOffice will give you spreadsheet, Word documents, access, you know, like an Access database program if you're into that, PowerPoint. I mean, it's got it all, and it's free. But again, you've got to have internet service and be able to download it.
Typically with a basic Windows machine, even a basic Mac machine, you get your web browser, you got your email client. They come built into the computer. You get a basic word processor. You get a basic picture editor. But that's pretty much it that comes with the computer, and a couple of games usually too. We joke that Windows comes with solitaire and Mac comes with chess.
That's true. Good. Okay, I'm glad you told me that, because here I'm thinking I'm buying something I can use out of the box, and coming to find out it comes with practically nothing, you know?
Yeah. It's still usable. You can do basic typing and word processing on it and basic games, but generally speaking, you buy whatever additional software you want it to do.
Yeah, what'd you buy it with the intent to do?
Well, to hold my pictures. And like I said, I can get JPEGs on it, but I can't get any other kind of pictures on it.
Well, you can put any picture you want on it. You may not be able to view them.
Yeah, you're going to need other programs.
You need a viewer program.
Right. Uh-huh.
And typically, if you're using a digital camera to put pictures on the computer, they come with the management program for you.
Yeah, but I wanted to, you know, use it for word processing.
Yeah, you can use Notepad, which is, as its name suggests, just a quick notepad.
Yeah,
but Windows,
that's not very good.
Well,
Windows
also has WordPad built in, which is a little more sophisticated.
A little better.
Or you can download OpenOffice.
OpenOffice, like
they
mentioned.
Yeah, but he doesn't have internet.
No internet,
Yeah, but
go to the library.
Whatever you type up, whatever you print, it has a problem printing.
Well, you have to buy a printer in order to print, and the printer usually comes with driver disks, although it's often better to use the internet to download current disks.
Well, I got to use PDF files or Adobe Reader.
So you have to download the free Adobe Reader. So it's almost
Catch-22?
Yeah, it's a catch-22. It's very difficult to run a computer these days without having internet access of some sort.
Yeah.
Even if it's dial-up.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that.
Which, you know, again, that takes a little longer, but, I mean, you can get some dial-up services still for under $10 a month.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll try that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've been most helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Yeah, going back off to Windows 8, you know, again, we've been playing with it quite a bit, and unless you're a tablet user, get ready for a major change, and I can see a huge uproar. You know, with folks, if you know, especially in office environments, this one will meet great resistance.
You better be able to turn that off. The Metro interface that with the pretty sliding tiles is nice on a phone and a tablet, but on a desktop computer, I don't see how it's going to work.
I mean, that's going to cause the learning curve. I mean, getting that, and nowadays with businesses. I mean, you know, you've stayed from Windows 3.0. I mean, I'll even go back to Windows 286, if anybody remembers that. Windows 286, you always had the toolbars down at the bottom, and you could, you know, go to start, run, and, you know, find, or start in programs and always find stuff, even right on up to Windows 7. That has not changed. But to do this whole paradigm shift and not be able to easily find your icons and what you got to do, it's like, people are going to just get totally frustrated, and I can see it meeting great opposition. Great opposition. So they better wake up, smell the coffee, because this is doomed, and they've already labeled it as another Windows Vista ME.
Well, you know, on the Macintosh side of things, when we had to upgrade from Snow Leopard to Lion, that was a huge jump, and we had to get rid of our PowerPC programs because they wouldn't run anymore because...
Yep.
Rosetta was no longer included in the operating system, and Mountain Lion is coming out shortly, And I'm wondering if that's going to improve things or not.
Well, what else is it going to kill? Apple has sort of been, I guess known is the right word, for abandoning old users a lot faster than Microsoft has been.
Windows, I mean, they're still, you know,
yeah.
Windows 98. I got some Windows 98.
Yeah, you can buy a brand new PC and still run Windows 98, Windows 95, if you can find the disks anymore.
Virtual window.
And a lot of corporations resist upgrading their operating systems because their custom software they've written doesn't work anymore. Where Apple, generally speaking, tries to maintain backward compatibility, but every now and then they have to sacrifice backward compatibility for future growth. And typically we see 2 or 3 years of transition machine. So the PowerPC chip, which in itself was a huge transition from the Motorola 68000 chip, when we moved to the IBM PowerPC, we had that 68K emulator for 2 or 3 years that let us run our old software. And then when PowerPC was discontinued in 2006, which is 6 years ago now, we've been able to run those old programs in the Rosetta translator. But now with the shift to Intel machines and Snow Leopard, and especially Mountain Lion now, you can't run those old programs anymore. So if you've got programs that are more than 5 or 6 years old, they won't run on a current Mac, and you have to upgrade those. So it becomes part of the upgrade issue of learning what you're going to have to do. It's not just the cost of the operating system upgrade.
It's all your other apps.
It's your other apps you may have to upgrade as well.
All right, tell you what, we got to take a short break, but we will be back. And don't forget, you can give us a call with your questions. The numbers are 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415, or you can text me with your question at 585-209-9010 right here at member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Hello, this is Paul Conley. Join me early on Monday mornings from 1 a.m. to 6 a.m. on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And that brings us back to this edition of Soundbites on May 5th. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Rick Harrison.
And let's go back to, another news article?
Yeah, there's some.
I think we kind of killed Windows 8.
Yeah. There's been some interesting criticism lately in the news of Apple and taxes. So Apple responded to the tax criticism by highlighting its job creation. Apple responded last Sunday to criticism that the company goes to great lengths to cut its global tax bill by billions of dollars every year by trumpeting the incredible number of jobs it has created. The statement was in response to an in-depth report published on Saturday by the New York Times that depicted Apple as a pioneer in developing ways to sidestep taxes and claim companies seeking to do the same use its method as templates. New York Times is quoted as saying Apple serves as a window on how technology giants have reduced... Apple serves as a window on how technology giants have taken advantage of tax codes written for an industrial age and ill-suited for today's digital economy. In response, Apple said it was one of the biggest taxpayers in the U.S. Apple pays an enormous amount of taxes, which help our local, state, and federal governments, the company said. In the first half of fiscal year 2012, U.S. operations have generated $5 billion in federal and state income taxes, including income taxes withheld on employee stock gains, making Apple one of the top payers of U.S. taxes. Apple has more than 50,000 jobs in all 50 states of the U.S. And has created more than 500,000 new jobs from people who create components for our product and to the product it delivers to their customers. One of the criticisms was actually aimed at the New York Times for getting the numbers wrong. The way corporations announce their quarterly earnings is for the previous quarter last year. So one of the things New York Times was saying is that Apple had a huge quarter this year and they haven't paid any taxes based on their income last year. Well, they had a 95% increase in income last quarter. So imagine your company doubling its income over the quarter the year before. So last year, you're going to pay 95% less taxes than you did this year.
Mm-hmm.
And New York Times did the math wrong and basically are blaming Apple for paying so little taxes.
Oops. But they don't want to admit that they made the mistake.
Yeah, they haven't quite
retracted
the statement yet. One of the problems that Apple has been facing is that they do have nearly $100 billion in cash reserves, but about 60% of that is overseas, in foreign corporations, you know, foreign investments, things like that. They've been wanting to bring that cash back into the U.S., but there's something like a 60% tax when you bring money into the U.S. So they don't want to lose 60% of their money, so they've left it overseas. So they've actually been petitioning Congress to have a tax amnesty day or period to let companies bring money back into the U.S. without losing so much. You know,
that would make a lot of sense.
If you were going to lose 60% of your money by bringing it into the U.S., you wouldn't do it either.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
It's no different within the states.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Galisano. He turned around and left New York State, took up residency down in Florida.
Yeah, Florida has no income tax.
And,
they make so much money in tourism.
And he's saving so much money there by paying less income tax.
How many companies incorporate in Delaware because their corporate taxes are so low?
Mm-hmm.
So Apple's not doing anything illegal. They're just finding legal ways of cutting their tax bill, like all of us do.
And it's a whole problem. It's like a double-edged sword, like we've been saying right along. You know, the internet can be a great tool, and it can be the downfall of some companies, you know, because it gets reported out there, and sometimes the retractions don't get there, or they go on deaf ears that, you know, oh, they're doing this and this, and that's all people hear. And then if there's a retraction or anything else, it's never really found out on the internet. Because nowadays, let's face it, you can't do much without somebody having a camera in their phone or anything else that they can't take
it
a picture,
caught,
post
yeah.
it, and trying to get away with doing things nowadays, it's like, oh, forget it.
I just read a story this morning from I think it was an Indiana investigative news reporter, that he's been finding, and tax attorneys have been telling him as part of this investigation, that millions of illegal immigrants are filing fraudulent tax returns, income tax returns, claiming dependents that live in another country and getting $10,000 tax returns back because they're claiming nine dependents live with them. So it's just that when you fill out your own income tax form, you claim dependents.
Mm-hmm.
And the more dependents you claim, the greater your child withholding income tax, you know, whatever that clause is. So if you say you've got 10 dependents living in your house, you get a huge return.
But don't you usually have to verify it?
Well,
Social Security numbers?
Otherwise it's fraud.
Yeah, but I mean,
right,
no,
it is, and that's the point. It's fraud.
But I mean Social Security numbers.
You make them up. And especially now with electronic filing and electronic processing, there's very little checks and balances. This investigative reporter tried to talk to the IRS, and no one would talk to him about it. The tax attorneys he talked to said that they've been reporting this to the IRS for years. You know, one single address will have four families living in it. You know, one of them they found had four families living in it with 20 children declared, and there was actually one guy and his daughter really living in a mobile home. And rampant fraud going on in the government, you know, multi-billion dollars being lost, and the IRS doesn't seem to care.
Oh, I think they care. They just haven't caught up with
them. They haven't caught up with it.
Yeah. I mean, hello.
So what it ends up being is more audits for average folk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they can't, you know, do their job. They sit there and throw it on everybody else. You know, you got to prove this or you got to prove that.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. I've been declaring this.
Right. You signed it that you have 20 dependents, so you must have 20 dependents, right? We believe you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I read that a couple of years ago in here in Rochester in welfare fraud. There was a house that was claiming something like 20 dependents, and we're getting $20,000, $30,000 a month in aid for all the people that didn't live there. And they finally got caught after a couple of years.
Yeah, I still don't get it. You know what I mean?
It's, you know, rampant fraud. People think they can get away with it, and for quite a while, they often do.
Yeah, but it's going to
eventually catch up to
you.
Yeah,
you know, the checks. What? There was just another supervisor, head of a school board or something that just got nailed for embezzling money. It was just on the news.
Yeah. It was the TSA guys that got arrested for stealing electronics out of suitcases.
Yeah, there are a lot of iPads
mostly
missing.
iPads, yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff, you know. And
there's bad guys everywhere, and eventually they get caught, but
But I mean the folks that sit there and embezzle money. Hello, nowadays with all the computers, you know, that sit there and run checks and everything else, and, you know, pull off reports, you can do a report usually now on a computer. It doesn't take months or years, you know, and quick, you know, pull out a report and boom, see discrepancies.
Well, now there's a lot of cybercrime going on.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Did you see where the Ministry of Defense in the UK said that, oh, yeah, our systems, you know, they broke into them, and we don't know how many times this has happened yet. We're trying to get our hands on it.
Well, I just had, through my bank, I got a notice that the one of my credit cards for the business could be compromised. And sure enough, I was out one evening, I get this call. And Mr. Enright? Yes. Did you just charge, I think it was $8.57, and they mentioned what it was for? No, I'm not even there. I'm here in Rochester. We didn't think so because they put it in and then quick reversed it. So we're shutting that card down. I go, well, thank you very much. Of course, it was a pain in the butt because now I had to go back to my bank, get that card shredded.
And how many auto payments have you set up on that card?
Yeah, I'll get another one for the business. And it's like...
Actually, I read about that happening with cell phone data plans, that if you're grandfathered in to the unlimited data plan and you've got an auto pay on your credit card... Now, say it doesn't have to be your credit card is stolen. It could be that it expired and you didn't put the new number in yet.
Yep, or the date.
They cancel your unlimited data plan because... The account expired.
Oh,
and then
no.
And you can't get it back.
That's dirty.
Some said they were, I think it was probably on Stop the Cap I read about this, that they said, you know, you can call up and ask a one-time exception. You know, my credit card expired and I forgot to put it in to get your unlimited grandfather back in. But but it's nasty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, they're going to find different ways that they can stick it to you.
Yeah, more than 10 million credit cards may have been compromised. This was early March. A processor that handles Visa and MasterCard payments got attacked as well.
Yeah, and like you say, it's just a big hassle because you get it set up with different vendors and everything else. And so, oh, shoot, I got to go in, put in, you know, a whole new credit card, fill out, and try to, like you say, get the ones that you do and, you know, hopefully, you know, if you got auto pay and, like you say, oh, shoot, they hit it, and all of a sudden you get a nasty gram from them. Well, we cannot process this due to this and that. Yep. Oh, shoot, forgot about that one. Yep. Let's try again.
If you catch it soon enough, and there's a lot of fraud protection already on accounts, so you usually aren't on the hook for the money.
No, I didn't
get it. But it's just a pain in the butt to go through all that and
You got to take the time and effort and go back into all of your accounts that you just take for granted over time. I mean, for me, you know, taking over all the stuff that my wife used to do, you know, now for 2 years, you know, I've just kind of, I'll admit it, I've gotten kind of complacent. It just automatically happens. And now you get to notice, oh, yeah, the card's going to come in. I've gotten really good about doing that. But when you get somebody like the fraud thing and that, it's like, oh, shoot. And got to sit there. And, you know, it's time out of your day.
You have to waste a lot of time trying to straighten everything out.
Sometimes it's interesting to see what gets flagged and what doesn't. I remember Christmas, I think last year or year before, the $500 thing I bought went through okay, but the $50 thing they flagged as potential fraud. Maybe because I had just done a $500 thing.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes what the bad guys do. They'll run a couple of small charges to see if it goes through.
Does it work?
And if because most people don't look at their bank statements and don't look at their credit card statements, sometimes not even monthly, they'll just pay the bill. And so if it goes through, they'll just start running it up and draining it.
Well, see, with the business, you know, I'm literally checking that daily.
Yeah.
You know, all my accounts, because no, I don't trust it.
My wife laughs at me for checking my balances almost every day.
I do, and I mean, for the business, it just keeps me on top of things, and it's just like reconciling.
Yep.
You know, a lot of folks will wait until reconcile to the end of the month. No, I am not a big accountant.
I've almost stopped.
I reconcile literally just about every 2 to 3 days.
Yeah, I've almost stopped reconciling with my paper statement at the end of the month because I reconcile every day along the way.
I do it.
It's out of date.
Yeah, the paper statements are out of date.
Well, I do it within, you know, I use QuickBooks for the business, QuickBooks Pro, and then I use Quicken for my own personal. And in both of them, I can nail it down to the penny within a day. And usually I got things in there before they hit the, you know, the actual account because sometimes places are a little day or so slower getting stuff in, but no, I stay
that,
right in.
That sometimes surprises me. I'll buy something at Wegmans, and in the 3 minutes it takes me to drive home, it's already out of the account.
Yeah.
But then I'll get gas at the gas station next door, and it takes 4 days to process.
Yeah, it can take a few days. But I got in the habit, you know, I just set the receipts right there
and
do it because, I say, it was a big change in going back for a moment there. My wife, once I started showing her how I used to do my checkbook. Now, she was a CPA.
Yeah, close enough.
Well, no, I always... here was my philosophy. You know, and I did this for umpteen years before I met her. I would sit there, and if, say, a check is for $16.47, it went into the registry as $17. I always round it up. And she goes, wait a minute, how do you reconcile? I go, well, at the end of the year, I look at that statement, and I see... November, what it says I should have and what I do have, and I go, Christmas bonus. She goes, no, you can't do that. I go, I do it every year, and in all the years, I've never bounced a check.
All right, why don't we take a...
We got a call.
Yeah, we'll take him a few minutes to go with that. Let's take a question we got on our email. We have an email form on our website at soundbites.org. So we had a call from Les, or a question from Les and Kathy. Have purchased Kaspersky Lab and am so far happy with it. Do you still suggest I have to run the Tango? And music for Dave, he likes Pink Floyd. And I really like that jazz CD that Dave plays of rock versions of jazz versions of rock songs. So with Kaspersky software, yes, Kaspersky is a pretty good antivirus software, but we still do recommend running the Tango because quite often you need the other programs too to catch everything. A single program generally can't catch everything. So we in the Security Tango at securitytango.com, we talk about the anti-malware, anti-phishing, antivirus, anti-everything. And it is a good idea to run them every now and then as well. And there's the music I was waiting for.
Yep. With that, folks, we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we got Larry sitting on the phone. He's got a question for us. But, you know, the numbers, again, are 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Whether you got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. That's what we're here every Saturday from 12 to 2 is to answer your computer questions and hope to throw a little knowledge your way right here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
The longest-running computer show in the known universe. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Rick Harrison.
And
you're loud enough that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we'll bring him down a little bit. Yeah. No, it's playing. Well, see, I've got the board set. I can come in without even thinking, set the levels because I know Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Steve as far as where it should be on the board. I've just, over the years. But then you get somebody else in who doesn't jump on it as much as Nick does. It's like, okay, I'll bump you back up a little bit.
Yeah, it's better now.
There we go. All right, you had another one there.
Didn't we have a caller?
Oh, duh. Yeah, we got Larry from Rochester. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
Hey, how are you?
Good, sir. Yourself? What's your question?
Good. Yeah, I'm with you guys 100% about, you know, it's just almost automatic with me where I check my bank online bank statement every day and my credit card account. And it really paid off about 2 months ago. I was checking the credit card, and I see two charges to two different of the two of the three credit reporting agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I didn't do any business with Experian or I think the other one was TransUnion. So I called them up, and I told them, I didn't do any business with you. What's this charge? And they said, you ordered, or somebody ordered, their credit report. And I said, with my credit card number? And they had me repeat the number, and they said, yeah, with your credit card number. Now, what kind of an idiot orders their own credit report with a stolen credit card number?
To see how good your credit is so they can apply for more credit cards.
No, they ordered their own.
They ordered their credit card, their credit report with his credit card.
So
John Smith ordered Joe Williams.
Right. Yeah, that's crazy.
So now they know where to find the bad guy.
One. So, they said no problem. They reversed, they took the charges off right away. And what they do, you only have to report that to one of them, and the other, they report that to the other two automatically, that's, ID theft.
Yeah.
And they put a 90-day initial fraud alert on your account, which makes it practically impossible for anybody to do that again until you have time to get... you just have to supply some information to them in writing, and they'll put a 7-year fraud alert on all your accounts.
Yep.
So nobody can do anything except you. When you go to open a new account or whatever, you got to, go through a couple of extra hoops.
Sometimes it can be a little extra hassle for yourself fraud protects.
Right.
Yeah.
But it pretty much locks everybody else out.
Yep.
But the other funny thing is, one of the guys told me, he says, most people don't realize, though, now when we get these things, we have a special database where that person's name goes in there as an ID thief.
Yep. And whenever they try to do something else, you catch them there, yeah.
Exactly. I pressed them, and here's another funny thing about it. I pressed them and I pressed them and I pressed them for who, what,
a name or something?
A name, right. And they said, I know it sounds crazy, but we have to protect them too, so we can't give you the name and address and all that stuff. But do you know anybody named Gloria M?
Interesting.
I said, I have no idea who Gloria M is. He said, well, Gloria M is going into the ID thief database.
It may have been a simple error where she read or typed her own credit card number wrong, and her card number is one or two digits different than yours.
No, twice.
Yeah.
Two different companies with the same expiration date.
Yeah, so that's pretty good fraud. One of the things we've also seen is there's a lot of places online that offer free credit reports, but in the very fine print, it says you're joining a service.
Right.
And that's sometimes where some of these fraudulent charges come from, because you didn't know you were joining the service.
Yeah. Well, then there's phishing that can go on, too, that way.
Yeah.
One of my rules...
Anyway, I just thought it was maddening, like you say, because you got to, go and change things that are automatically...
And if you waited till the end of the month to get your paper statement, you may not have noticed it then. You may not have had enough time to do it, and it may have been too late by then.
Yeah. Well, I had to get new cards anyway, and then they changed everything. But now it's locked down quite tight.
Yep.
And I just thought in amazement, what kind of idiot orders their own credit report?
Yeah.
Stolen credit card number.
Well, that's the dumb criminals that keep getting caught.
Yeah, someone who wants to get caught is doing that.
Anyway, you're absolutely right, though. I mean, it's just something I do automatically every day, like checking my email.
Yep. It's...
Doesn't hurt.
You can't hurt nowadays.
Be vigilant.
No. Yep.
I think it was the next day or 2 days after that I caught it.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, no, what we got to do is stay on top of it, especially if you want to use the internet and you're putting your credit cards in there. That's where I'm a big fan of, say, with the iTunes. I go and buy the cards.
Yeah, buy a gift card.
Buy the gift card.
$15, $25, something like that.
And then you come in, scratch that off, put that code in there, and then you're one less place that you're putting a credit card number.
There have been problems with kids getting their parents' password and running up the credit card on iTunes.
Wow.
And people have tried to sue Apple over that.
Well, another thing you can do is you can buy, if you're going to buy stuff online, is just go to Walmart or wherever they sell and buy a prepaid Visa or prepaid card,
whatever. It doesn't necessarily have to be an online fraud issue that you go to a restaurant and give your credit card to a waiter who disappears with it for 20 minutes. Every now and then, you see someone get arrested for scanning credit cards at checkouts.
Yep, I'm very wary of letting a card out of my sight.
Yeah.
Now, we used to use our debit card for all kinds of stuff like that at restaurants and all that. And about 2 years ago, I told my wife, from now on, use the credit card for everything,
it's
the debit card.
It's a little trickier with a debit card because the money's gone from your account immediately.
And the rules are different, too.
Is much harder than getting credit card charges reversed.
Yeah, the credit card, it's, what, a $50 limit there that you're charged for if there's something fraudulent that you find?
Yep.
And whereas if it's a debit card, no, that rule doesn't apply.
Although most of the companies waive that for you anyway. But
getting the funds back in your account, that's another story.
Yeah, and you want to make sure that all those other checks you've written haven't bounced in the meantime.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's my 2 cents worth.
All right. Well, have a good one, sir. Thank you for calling.
You too.
Yeah, it pays to be vigilant. You never know what you're going to catch.
Yeah, what I was saying before is one of my rules is if someone is contacting me via email about something, you want to make sure that you go directly to the site itself. If you're interested, don't click on the link that's in the email.
Never click on a link in your email because, you know, even if it's your friend Sally that sent you an email, you don't know if it's really your friend. Yeah. Never download anything you didn't go looking for. So if that sounds like something cool, you go to the website yourself. You type the address yourself. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a pain, but it stops a lot of these bad programs from sneaking into your computer.
All right, let's see if we can sneak Ed in just before the break. Go ahead, Ed. You got a question?
Hi, I've got two, what I think are very quick questions.
Go ahead.
What town are you from?
The first one,
Ithaca.
Does the brick on a laptop act as a surge protector at all?
No, not really. Okay. I mean,
a little bit.
It's
converting AC to DC, so
it's got the transformer.
Yeah. But surges are an incredibly unlikely occurrence.
Or drops.
Brownouts and dips and drops are much more likely.
Uh-huh.
And the AC adapter, you know, transformer on your laptop and the battery on your laptop can help with that a little bit more. In fact, what we often see when there's a power failure, a power fluctuation, you know, desktop computers will turn themselves off, but laptops stay running because they've got a battery to handle that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like your own portable UPS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, you got to be, I wouldn't rely on one of those.
Don't rely on it. No. Okay, great. The second question is it possible to send a text to a phone from a computer?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Next question?
Oh, you want to know how to do it?
Most of the cell phone services have a web-to-phone text interface. I know Verizon has their VZW.com for sending text messages from a computer to a cell phone. There's also a lot of apps you can get on your smartphone to send a message, send a text message without using cellular services even. Apple has a new program called Messages on their smartphones and for the computer, where you send text messages through the internet rather than over the cell service, so you don't need to pay for text messaging services.
Okay, but Verizon has something that I can use to send to a Verizon phone?
Yeah, Verizon has a website, VZW.com, that you can send a text message to a Verizon phone. I'm sure AT&T and Sprint have the same options as well.
Yeah, just gotta go.
Do a Google for send.
Go into that particular webpage, say for AT&T, and do a search within there.
Yeah, send a text from the website.
You'll find it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for all your help.
You're quite welcome, sir. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, a lot of people are cutting back on their minute plans and their cell plans now, cellular text plans, because you can do email, you can do messaging over the internet, and so they're increasing their data plans because they're decreasing their minute plans. Because it's kind of funny. We hear jokes all the time. People don't use their phones for making phone calls anymore. It's all email and text.
Yep.
Oh yeah, I do a ton of texting. I mean, it's just the way the world has gotten. You know, I mean, ordering stuff and all that. I can, you know, text my two distributors instead of sitting there going through the whole phone maze and everything else. But I can just quick, you know, give either one of them a quick text. Hey, I'm looking for this. Can you help me out with that? You know, and they'll get back to me. All right, give me a little bit. I'll look into it. And then, bam, I get another text back. And, then, you know, just, oh, okay, do order it. You know, and it's like, and I can be out on and about, and it's already done, not having to go back, call them, and go through the maze, and wait to get them online, and then have them look it up and say, all right, well, then I got to get back to you. It's just easier with the text, and yep. Bam, it's there.
Yeah, I think the texting is becoming the new email these days.
Yeah. I almost don't like to talk to people.
Well, the texting has taken
too
over.
It takes too long, yeah. And you got to, and well, it's one of the things that I run into a lot, and you do probably too, Dave. Dave.
Sure,
Dave runs into it. Yeah, I can't talk today.
A new mouth.
I've got the Nixon syndrome. But you call a customer and ask them a question. You know, I need your password, or even just, you know, your computer's done, and you leave a message, and they call back. You called me.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got several people in our office. Who knows who answered the phone?
Yeah. And who?
And
who is it?
Right. Who is this? And, you know, and did you
who
listen?
Did you talk to?
Yeah. You know, did you listen to the message? Oh, no, I just called. Because they see the call ID. And so I routinely now block call ID so they can't just call back. Make them listen to the message.
Ooh.
Well, and part of the problem, too, is we use Magic Jack to make all our phone calls. $20 a year, unlimited phone calls. It's really, really great. It's a voice over IP, little USB thing plugs into your computer, and they've got a new version now that plugs directly into the internet.
How many lines?
Well, it's one line, so $20 per year per line, not per month. We call out on the Magic Jack, and they'll call back on the Magic Jack because that's what the call ID said. So we've started doing forwarding of our Magic Jack back to our main phone number.
Yeah. Now, do you ever have it drop out? I've had it do that to me a few times.
We do have a little bit of problem with dropouts because our security cameras are using a lot of our bandwidth. Hmm. So if, you know, if we're going to do a long, complicated call, then we'll shut down some of our security recording. But yeah, it works really, really great for sending making phone calls. And what's really cool is the Magic Jack device, you carry it with you. The phone number stays with the device. So you go home, and that's your phone number. You go to work, that's your phone number.
Hmm.
You go to another city, and your phone number stays the same.
Yep.
And people at the other end just see a phone number.
They don't know
any difference. Yeah.
Yeah, you could be anywhere in the world, and
yeah,
still gonna be. But now, is there roaming charges?
No.
Well,
it's over Wi-Fi.
Well, the Magic Jack service itself is U.S. only. Well, not only, but it's $20 per year. Unlimited calling in the U.S.
Okay.
Canada's a couple cents a minute. Mexico's a couple cents a minute. So they do have foreign rates that are usually significantly lower than the phone company charges you. Mm-hmm. So you can do international calling on it at a lower rate.
It was kind of like Vonage that way.
Yeah, but Vonage is $20 a month for voice over internet. Magic Jack is $20 a year. It sounds too good to be true, but we've been using it 4 or 5 years now, and it works fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, though, but if you got multiple lines within a shop.
Yeah, then you need multiple Magic Jacks.
And can they roll over from one to the other?
Yeah, you can forward one to the next if you want to.
Oh, okay. So if one line's busy, you can roll to the next.
We looked into to the local phone company to do voice over IP on a DSL line, and it was, you know, $500 or $600 a month. It was ridiculous. Well, that's for large businesses. Well, we're trying to save money, not
waste it.
Waste money, yeah.
That is kind of foolish.
Yeah.
No, I don't get that one at all. Oh, well. All right, with that, folks, it's coming up to the top of the hour. Yes, you've, as Nick would say, I won't say wasted, but maybe gained some knowledge within the past hour, but you know what? There's still another full hour to even gain more right here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1. You know, again, the numbers are 966-5299, 1-800-790-0415. If you have a question, pick up the phone and give us a call.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon. You are listening to Soundbites on May the 5th, and I am Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have another caller on the phone. We have Mike from Webster. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, how are you guys? I just got on the radio. What happened to Nick? Is he all right?
Oh, yeah. No, he's just taking a day off. Once in a while, the three of us, you know, occasionally we'll do that once in a while, you know, have this thing called a life. And
we can probably say where he's at because it's a public event. It's the Imagine RIT down at RIT. It's basically a showcase of cool technologies. And, ooh, it's a swarm of tiny autonomous robots. I want to go see that.
And we're missing it.
And we're missing it. We have to head down there afterwards.
Nick taking a day off for something to do with computers.
Well, yeah, because in his other business, or his other life, he is...
an entrepreneur.
Well, no, I'm the what's his title? He's the head IT guy
for the
The
Saunders,
E. Philip Saunders College of Business at Rochester Institute of Technology.
Very good.
That's a mouthful. Very well done.
That's a mouthful. Yeah.
I'm relatively naive about computers, so you guys bear with me. I have an HP, and I have shortcuts like Yahoo and Google set up on the main screen, and when I highlight them to get them on the main screen, sometimes they come up only half a screen, so I have to widen the picture. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that I can do to prevent that from happening?
It's the size of the window that's opening, and it's supposed to remember the size it was last at.
Right.
Sometimes
this HP has an advantage. Well, they say it's an advantage on the touch screen on the bottom, where you can take your fingers on certain websites and you can change the diameters of the pictures.
Yeah.
So I thought it had something to do with that, but
it's just the window size.
Yeah.
There's two things you can do, and neither of them might work. But when you have the window set to the size you want it to be, hit the F5 key on your keyboard.
Okay.
That's supposed to do a refresh and save the size of the screen.
F5,
yeah.
So when you reopen it, it will be that size.
That size again. The other thing you can do is if you right-click on that shortcut, on the desktop, and in one of the properties, right-click and choose properties, one of the properties in there is window size. And,
uh-huh.
and you may be able to set a window size, so you can set it to go to full screen or set it to a specific size if you want to. Generally,
either F5 or right-click in properties and look for size.
Right.
Yep.
Generally, what's happened over the years is that screens have gotten bigger and bigger. So what used to do, when you had your 13-inch screen, when you opened a window, it always opened full size because 13 inches was... Now we've got 25, 30-inch screens, and they open in a smaller window. It's probably still that 13-inch of the original screen size.
Yeah.
But it doesn't...
Well, my issue is that I can be looking at this screen or this website many, many times for a long time, and all of a sudden, either I'm thinking I pushed something wrong or whatever, it comes up, and it's only half the size. It's the bottom half of the picture or only the top half, and it's...
Yeah, it's kind of a fluke in the way the operating systems work, that when you open a window, and then if a window is that small and you open a new window, it'll pick the size that the last window was, because it thinks that's the size you meant. Yeah. Now, are you using?
Thank you guys for having patience to talk to an old guy that doesn't know much about
it. Sure, no problem.
That's what we're here for.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yep. There's a couple of neat window management features. In fact, there's one in Windows 7 that I like, and I found one that does the same thing on the Mac. If you drag a window by the edge or by the title bar to move that window on your screen, under Windows 7. If you move it toward the edge of your screen, it will jump and fill that edge of the screen. So you move it toward the left edge, it auto-resizes to fill the left side of your screen and or the right side. So I found a program on the Mac that does that called Size Up. So you can automatically, either with a keyboard control or a mouse control, move the window to so always fill the left half of the screen, the right half of the screen, top half or bottom half. And it's a pretty neat thing, especially when you have a really big screen and it's nice to see two pages side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a setting in Snow Leopard that you were able to set in the terminal where you could tell either the application or you could tell the operating system what size you want to be viewing things at.
Yeah.
But when we moved to Lion, that disappeared.
That changed, yep.
So I was very disappointed. So
there's two programs from the same company. I'm trying to find it here. There's Cinch, which has a lot more features, and it does mouse movements as well, or Size Up, which does keyboard commands to size your windows.
All right. Well, tell you what, let's go back to the phone. We've got Phil in Greece. Go ahead, Phil.
Yes, I had a suggestion for the finding the texting to a phone and a computer.
Mm-hmm.
If you send a text from your email to your email, I should say, I'm sorry, from your phone, then the return address that will appear in your email will actually be where you can text to from your phone. And it'll appear in your
computer. Yeah, nice tip. A lot of times it's the full 10-digit phone number, you know, 585-555-1212 at vzw.com for Verizon,
yep,
or att.com for ATT. So oftentimes that will work to send a text message to a cell phone,
mm-hmm,
from your email. Very nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Good
one.
That's pretty slick.
Nice tip.
Yep. Now,
that's what it's all about. And
yeah,
like the other caller, Mike, there said, you know, putting up with somebody that doesn't know much. Well, that's what the show is all about. This is what Nick, Steve, and I have been doing now for 23 years, is answering questions. And I have one philosophy. There is no dumb question. The only dumb question is the one that you don't ask, because without that, you can't gain knowledge. And we enjoy it. I mean, we've gotten very technical questions. We've gotten very simple questions and everything in between. And, I mean, in our whole spectrum, it goes from very young kids. What, we had a 6-year-old one-time call and people in their 90s and everybody in between.
Yep.
I'll tell you about one of my pet peeves. I was using the iPad earlier today, and I use this news service called News 360. It's a wonderful application. It kind of brings in news from all over the web, the internet, and displays it to you. Well, there was one article I wanted to go to, and it happened to go to the ABC News website. And when I was going to that page, it said, oh, would you like to use the iPad app? No, I want to continue on and see the article. I'm in Safari. I'm happy with Safari. I don't want to download your app. There was no bypass to it whatsoever. And, you know, I'm already in the application I want to use. I don't want to have to download another application and then later on, you know, have to search for that application just so I can view this one article on ABC News.
Now, from their point of view, if you use their app, they get paid more. And that's why they're doing it.
Yep.
But a lot of websites have started doing that. It's nice when a website has a mobile version, because a lot of smartphones don't handle full websites very well. But at least give us the option to not use the mobile version and use the full, because especially Safari on the iPad, it's a full web browser on a full-size screen.
Yeah, and I've been to the ABC News website on my normal computer. I know how that website works. I can navigate around. If you suddenly force me into an iPad app, I have a whole new learning curve.
Linda just came in.
Yeah. Ready for George?
That was my pet peeve
for
the day.
So if you're creating a website, it's nice to have a mobile version, but give the user the choice of using the mobile version or the full version.
Yep.
I just remember back in the olden days of the BlackBerry, when you had that tiny 3-inch, you know, 2-inch screen, and you could put like 10 lines of text on it, they had to make special, really tiny websites. And not a lot of companies bothered with that.
Yeah. All right, tell you what, we can go back to the phone, and there's Marco from Sherlock. Go ahead, Marco.
Well, hello. My question today is on a relatively new Western Digital hard drive I have. It's a small laptop-sized hard drive I bought for my laptop. Now it's in an enclosure. It keeps on losing data. I'll format it, put just some junk on there just to see if it holds it, and every couple of days I'll click on it. It remains hooked to my computer all through the time, and after I click on it after a couple of days, the data is gone. It says file or directory corrupt, can't read hard drive. Do I need to fully F-disk this thing and partition it, or should I just send it back to Western Digital for exchange?
If it's still under warranty, the easiest thing is probably to send it back, because I would be suspicious of anything.
But shouldn't do that.
If you do a full F-disk on it, it will map out any bad blocks that may not be in the bad block table already. But there's also a program called SpinWrite from GRC.com, and it does a magic on hard drives where it looks at every single block on the hard drive to see if it can be read or not, and can fix bad blocks by mapping the data out and moving the data to other blocks. It can recover data from hard drives by doing all sorts of tricks to read the – it really, really, really – tries to read data on a drive.
Yep.
How much is that app?
It's about $80, so it's not too cheap for home users, but a lot of service people buy it themselves to service drives. But yeah, if you're under warranty, the easiest thing would be to send it back.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, and thanks to Computer Leak Magazine, I found that the website where showed that I had some warranty left, and then I got the RA started
warranty
anyway.
Check.
So
yeah. Now, the other thing,
that's probably what I'll do.
The other thing that's possible is it may not be the drive, it may be the enclosure you put it in.
I've seen enclosures fail,
be my next
too.
Question.
Yeah, so if you have a different drive or different enclosure, try swapping something.
Now, here's the thing, though. If you can put that drive back into the computer as a second drive and test it out that
laptop,
way.
So it's probably, it's probably only one, only one bay in your laptop.
It's small, so it won't, plug into the IDE cables in my mainframe computer.
Well, that's one thing I really like about SATA drives. The connectors are the same on 2.5 and 3.5. Mm-hmm. The bay might be a different size, but the connectors are the same, and you can still hook it in
golden.
There. But in IDE, it was different. 2.5 and 3.5 and 5.25 all had different IDE connectors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you what. The original reason I pulled it out of the laptop is just because one day after about maybe 6-7 months of using it, it suddenly gave me a disk read error. On that, I couldn't get around. I couldn't get, and I thought maybe it was either the motherboard, maybe the motherboard battery died. It was a pretty old laptop. Because I knew it was a problem between the motherboard and the hard drive, just not reading each other.
Yeah.
I thought the hard drive should still be good. That's why I bought the enclosure and had been using it that way. But now that it keeps on hiccuping every couple weeks, I started thinking, well, maybe it is the hard drive.
Yeah, no, if it was giving you issues before you even changed it out, I would be very suspicious and I would get it back while it's still under warranty.
So being as new as it is, it's still probably...
I've seen hard drives fail right out of the bag.
Yep.
Okay.
It does happen.
Yeah, I hear on podcasts I listen to where they talk about SpinWrite, a lot of people run it on brand new drives that come from the factory, that it can keep drives from failing if you run it regularly.
Oh, neat.
But I'm always leery of a drive that has block errors or read errors already. But the thing is that hard drives typically have so much data on them already. So a terabyte hard drive, that's a trillion bytes. That's 8 trillion bits of data. So 8 trillion little tiny magnetic particles that are going north-south or south-north.
Mm-hmm.
And drives come with bad blocks, known bad blocks, in a bad block table, and with a spare capacity so that when a block fails, they can try to move the data to another block.
Remap it to another area.
But all that's handled by the drive controller itself, and you never see it happen. If something gets bad enough for you to see it happen, I wouldn't trust that drive anymore.
It's the old FAT table.
Yeah.
Right. All right, sounds good. Thank you for all the info.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you want to be really wary if your block zero failed, because that's where your partition table is. That's where your boot blocks are.
But, speaking of hard drives, everything's starting to move to these solid-state drives.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a whole new ball game.
Yep. Solid-state drives are really, really fast with no moving parts. But right now, they're almost ludicrously expensive compared to solid-state hard drives. I've been looking for a customer for a drive. And in SSD, there's slow ones and there's fast ones. So we found a 512 gig SSD. The slow version is slow for SSD is $500, and the fast version is $1,100 for 500 gig hard drive. You can buy 1 terabyte drive for like $100.
Yeah, there's definitely a cost difference. Yeah.
But it's really, really fast.
It's very, very fast. That's mm-hmm. right.
Yep.
Well, it's drive space has just gotten so cheap. Well, yeah. And the prices have finally come back down because
after the flooding in Thailand, yeah.
Yeah, that was
but as soon
ridiculous.
As SSDs can be cost competitive with HDs, we'll probably see an end to HD. Although 3.5-inch HDs now have peaked out at 4 terabytes. They've got a 4 terabyte model. But that's a lot of data to lose, too.
Yeah, that.
So you need another one to back it up to.
Yeah, to ghost it, or at least mirror it.
Some sort of mirror and backup, yeah.
Yeah, you got it nowadays. So to be that dangerous, well, folks go, partition it. It's still the same hard drive. Hello?
Yep.
That's right.
They don't get that.
The whole thing goes.
Yeah, you don't back up your internal drive to your internal drive.
Yep.
All right, tell you what, that indicates that we got to take a short break. And we still got plenty of time. We've got Joe from Cheektowaga sitting on the phone. We'll get to him as soon as we come back from these great messages. But, you know, pick up the phone if you got a particular computer question, just like Mike and the rest of the folks, at 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415, right here at Member Supported, Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
And you are listening to this edition of Sound Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have, it's Joe from Cheektowaga. Go ahead, Joe. What do you know?
Well, for the person before that was asking about SMS, if they get a Google Voice account, they can both send and receive SMS messages with their Google Voice account.
That's
one thing.
That's pretty cool, yeah. And then you get a phone number that you can make phone calls from your computer. Actual phone calls in addition to texting.
Oh, yes. And forward your Google Voice to any numbers you want, up to six of them simultaneously. It's a good routing tool and voicemail tool as well. But for the problem at hand, yeah, they can use Google Voice to send text messages. Then they don't have to worry about, well, is it a Sprint number? Is it a Metro PCS number? Yep. Is it an AT&T number? They don't have to worry. The system figures that out. There's a couple limitations to it. If anybody ever tries to send you a picture, you won't get any message whatsoever. I had somebody reply once with, I asked them, gee, so how's the baby doing? And they tried to send a picture back to me of the kid, and I didn't see anything.
Yeah, and, so it's SMS only, it's not MMS.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
And you can't do short codes. Like there's a Buffalo area radio station that says, oh yeah, send a text to their 5-digit code. I can't do that, nothing happens. It doesn't even give you an error message. It doesn't even allow you to
goes to bit heaven.
Those short codes. What?
It goes to bit heaven.
Bit heaven, yes, exactly. And for the sites that you're trying to view that say, oh, use our app, I do not know if Safari has the capability, but I can tell you Opera and Firefox both support faking the user agent header for a lot of sites that say, yeah, you must use like Internet Explorer to view our site. You can sometimes just fake it out and say, hey, I have the desktop version of Opera and get the
Safari
Opera
does
content.
Do that.
Yeah, Safari on the desktop does that, but Safari on the iPad doesn't.
No.
That I know of.
That's correct.
But there are other browsers on the iPad that do. Yeah, so yes, thank you. Yeah, changing your user agent.
Yep.
To tell them you're using. In fact, we used to do that on the Mac when website said you must be using Internet Explorer to look at this website.
You'd say, okay,
and,
Safari.
Okay, Safari. Okay. Just tell it you're Internet Explorer and it works fine.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks
Take
for calling.
Easy.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
So that's pretty interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a quick minute here and remind everyone that the Apple Cider meeting is coming up on Wednesday. That's May 9th at 7 p.m. over at the East High School Forum Room. That's on 1801 East Main Street in Rochester. The topics are Know Your Software, which is a 15-minute talk on Movieist, VLC, and Parian. It plays movies that QuickTime can't. We also have another 15-minute talk on Know Your Hardware, best Wi-Fi hard drives for your iPhone and iPad. And we also have Know Your Music, review of U-Rock Guitar, which is a $200 MIDI guitar. Our keynote will be on Dragon Dictate and Google Voice Transcribe. It's the state-of-the-art technology.
Yeah, so if you're into Apples and iPads, or even if you just want to check out how the other side lives, that's this coming Wednesday at 7 p.m. at East High School.
Okay, with that, let's go back to Sal from Fairport. Go ahead, Sal.
Hey, I just had a question. You guys have the Tango for the different operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
What specifically are the benefits for each one that you're getting? I know what the Windows one you've had for a while and the benefits out of, you know, getting malware and all that.
They're just tools that help keep those additional operating systems clean.
Yes, it's the same sort of benefits for the Mac and the Linux Tangos. SecurityTango.com, and then if you go to the Let's Dance button, there's the Windows Waltz, the Linux Lambada, the Android Allemande, and the Mac Garena. And it lists programs that you may want to run to help clean your computer from spyware and viruses and whatnot. We're seeing a surge in the last couple of months in malware for the Mac, exploiting holes. The one of them was a hole in Flash, one was a hole in Java. One of the news reports was saying with the Flashback, which was a fake Flash installer that exploited a hole in Java. We're making the authors up to $10,000 a day for people that got tricked into installing it. But it's the same thing on the Mac side that we've said on the Windows side. Keep your updates installed and update OS, update Java, update Flash when you need to keep yourself free of those problems. But on the Mac side, it was a fake Flash update. A message popped up and said you need to update Flash. It wasn't from Adobe. It was a fake update, so that was a big issue too. And so what we're seeing on the Mac side is a little surge in that type of malware. And there was some headlines last week that one of the web was it Sophos or Kaspersky, one of the antivirus companies, said that of all the Macs they were scanning, 80% of them were infected with malware, and that made all the headlines. They didn't say it was Windows malware.
I think Kaspersky and they were talking about how Macs are 10 years behind in security, which I find very
because they haven't
hard to believe.
No, they haven't had to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, and the security that's sort of built into the OS is already there. They don't have the research that third party companies have done for Windows because it hasn't been necessary. In fact, one of the rebuttals to that article was saying that Microsoft doesn't do much security work themselves because Symantec and Kaspersky and Sophos and all the other companies do it.
They
for
leave
them.
It to others.
Yeah, but if you're on a Mac, you've gotten junk mail. You probably don't even see it because it's in your junk mail folder. But you've gotten junk mail with Windows viruses in it and Windows malware in it. It can't do anything to your Mac, but it's in your junk mail box, and so that's what this Kaspersky scan was finding, The fear headline saying that 80% were infected with Windows viruses that can't do anything. But if you're in a situation where you're sharing your files with Windows users, which most of us do these days, it's a good idea to run some sort of an antivirus on your Mac. There's a bunch of free ones. There's iAntivirus. There's Clam. Sophos has a free antivirus as well. One of the problems with Sophos is it has to run as root. And most of the antivirus programs run as root, which is a very low level piece of the operating system because it has to be able to check operating system things that that the viruses can try to do. So some people don't like it because it runs as root, but I think all the AV companies have to run as root. Same thing on Windows; it has to run in what's called Ring Zero as the administrator, so it can catch things that sneak into Windows.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for
Have
calling.
A good one, sir.
Let's see. I haven't seen the Android Allemande. I don't know enough about dancing to know what an Alamande is.
So the antivirus on the Mac, really, we've got what? Clam AV. We've got the other one you were talking about.
iAntivirus from PC Tools.
That's right. And then there is...
Well, Norton makes a commercial one. McAfee makes a commercial one. All the big commercial antivirus companies make one. Kaspersky makes one. Quite a few of them, Sophos I know of for sure because we played with it last week, makes a free version for home users. And a lot of the AV companies will do that. It's free for home users because businesses pay for enterprise site licenses.
Now, Clam AV is free, too.
Yeah, Clam is free. Clam is a little technical and a little geeky for average home
users.
That's
true. It's a little scary to use.
Yeah. iAntivirus is nice and easy, but I'm not sure if it does anti-malware as well. Oh, wait a minute. I don't like this. It looks like iAntivirus got bought by Symantec.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that'll kill it.
There it goes.
iAntivirus.com. A new iAntivirus is on its way for Mac, and the big Norton logos are there.
Mm. Although Norton's gotten better. I mean, they did learn with their newer version right now. That is good.
It used to be really, really slow.
Oh, versions 6, 7, and 8. Oh, how could I put it politely? Stunk! They just didn't do anything other than take over your machine, slow it down, and cause more issues. So now the newer version, it just does a great job because they streamlined it. They actually rewrote the code from the bottom up, recompiled it so it runs smoother, faster, and it'll even prove to you that they're taking up less resources than they used to because you can run it with a meter.
That's one of the problems with an antivirus program. Is it has to check every single file that comes into the computer, every file that opens to see if it's a virus, every file you download to see if it's a virus. So it can slow things down dramatically by doing that.
So what do you think of things like Mac Keeper?
Mac Keeper advertises
they're basically
the hacked out of the web.
Yeah.
I almost feel it's one of the it isn't a fake program, but it almost feels like it because they advertise so much. They offer cleaning programs to clean the crap out of your computer, but with a lot of times it'll give you a list of stuff and these things can be deleted. Make sure you don't need them anymore.
Well, if you don't know your system,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're in real trouble.
And if you knew that to begin with, then you wouldn't need this program. So I don't like it by the fact that it's really an obtrusive advertiser and
it is.
Yeah. It's in your face.
So many ads pop up all the time. It's
in your
probably
face.
Not that bad a program, but it just advertises too much.
All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We got Gerd from Victor on the phone. Go ahead, Gerd.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Who walked in?
All of you guys.
He called us gentlemen.
I just went from Time Warner who walked in. Went from Time Warner to Frontier and Dish HD. I have a Lexmark X4650, and we have two laptops in the house, a Lenovo and one HP Tower. Since the installation or the change with the modem and wireless and all that stuff, the printer will no longer print, and it says that they're not connecting. I've now played around with the Lexmark's, check it out stuff, and I've tried to take the Lexmark off the computer and then use my CD to put it back on, and it still doesn't work.
I wonder if it's not seeing the IP addresses.
Well, is the printer directly connected to a computer, or is it connected to the network? Do you use a USB connection to your computer, or is it connected to the Wi-Fi on your network?
I believe it is connected to the computer.
Yeah, there'd be a cable going from the printer to the computer?
Over USB. So that should have no bearing on what your internet service is.
No.
Yeah.
But if the other computer is trying to print to it and the IP address is changed.
Yeah, the range has changed. Will it print from the computer it's connected to?
No. The only thing I can do is like a test, print a test thingy.
From the computer or from the printer?
From the printer.
From the printer. So the printer mechanically works.
Well, actually, I did this from the computer.
So it is printing from the computer.
Apparently.
Okay. What probably happened is when you got the new router for your new internet service, it might be on a different network range. And so all of your computers have different IP addresses.
Okay.
So on the other computer, you need to go into the printer control panel and remove the printer and re-add it so that it can find the new address of the computer it's connected to. And then you want to make sure that both your computers are connected to the network and they can both open web pages.
And that you don't have the firewall turned on in both the Windows programs.
Yeah, the firewall usually turns itself off when you share the printer out, but you may need to check your firewall settings on each computer to make sure that printing is allowed through the firewall.
And if you're using Norton, Norton will sometimes...
Yep, Norton.
Any virus can block.
Yeah, Norton firewall or the Zone Alarm firewall, whatever firewall you're using, you may have to open to let the printer through.
I use Norton.
Yeah, because you might have changing services.
Yeah.
It was set for the one, and now it knows it's got to allow this new network IP address to come through.
One thing you can try temporarily is disable Norton and then see if the other printers, the other computers can print.
That'll narrow it down for you.
And then you got to go into your Norton settings and allow the printer access through the firewall.
Yep. That's probably what it is, because Norton is very good about blocking that stuff.
Yeah.
And you got to go in and just tell, no, this is okay. It's safe. You can allow
it. Yeah. And what's the process name for file and print sharing? Because it's probably service host, right?
Yeah.
So something probably popped up on your screen and said service host wants access to the internet.
And depending on how you replied to it.
Yeah. There are so many. Service host is a generic process inside of Windows that a lot of...
Generic name, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of programs use it, both good and bad. So you have to allow the good programs to use it.
Okay.
That answer your question?
I'm not sure. But I'm going to play around some more. Thank you.
Yeah. What you want to do is check out the Norton. Try turning that off. That'll, start to narrow things down. Because if you can turn off Norton, you just disable it until, say, the next reboot.
Right.
And see if it'll connect there.
Okay.
That'll tell you whether, it's the Norton. That's going to narrow down a lot whether you can do things.
Okay. Yeah, always do things a step at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one change and see if it does anything.
That was good.
All righty.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
I had a weird problem at a customer this week that I'll tell you about after the break.
Okay.
Yeah, that music tells us we got to take one more break. And I appreciate all you folks that are calling, but we still have 20 minutes. If you've got a particular question, give us a call at 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. And you are listening to member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
And you are listening to the May 5th edition of Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And let's go to another news article for right now.
Alrighty. Amazon is moving into sitcoms. You can get just about anything on Amazon these days, and pretty soon that's going to include original sitcoms with the rollout of Amazon Studios. We are now developing original programming for Amazon Instant Video. Submit your children's series or comedy series idea. It could be the next hit show, says a message on the company website. The site is also advertising for writers on open writing assignments, which may pay up to $33,000. Amazon Studios had Roy Price tell All Things Digital that he wants the shows to feel like real TV shows, and the products will have production budgets to match. Amazon Studios is also running a premise war on its site, asking web visitors to choose between two competing pitches already at the studio. By the way, meet your newest tool for serious procrastination. Amazon already distributes video through its Instant Video service and has developed good relationships with the studios by streaming old TV shows and movies through that service. for people with a free subscription to Amazon Prime or one-off rentals starting at $2.99. Users can also buy digital copies as well. For that reason, Kafka from the All Things D notes that Amazon will probably manage to soothe any short-term studio concerns about its push into TV production by pointing out how much money the studio could make on that older content. Of course, Amazon already has a great distribution platform on Kindle Fire, which automatically puts access to the programming literally into the hands of millions of viewers. With that push, Amazon is taking on Netflix and Hulu, which already both have announced original programming, and working on the model taken off by Google's YouTube. YouTube has been investing in original content providers to become platforms. Amazon is taking the same approach, giving people with ideas an easy way to use them. But how much will this act like a traditional studio? Ready for Amazon sitcoms? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 585-966-5299. Or toll-free at 1-800-790-0465. Unfortunately, what we're seeing, the cord cutters, as we're calling them, people who want to cancel their cable TV bill in order to watch all their video on the internet with Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and digital downloads and iTunes, we're running into potential issues. The cable TV companies are seeing lost revenue. The movie companies and TV show companies are seeing a lost revenue. They don't see the additional revenue gained from Netflix and Hulu. They're just seeing losing revenue on cable TV subscriptions. So there's a lot of rumors that Hulu is going to start going to a subscription model where you have to be a cable TV subscriber in order to watch a show on Hulu.
Ouch.
Which is going to negate the whole usefulness of Hulu.
That's true. Well, then their website will just go down.
Yep. And people want to watch TV shows when they want to on whatever device they want to.
Yep.
They don't want to have to pay for it twice. You know, that's what we see the TV show companies. They want you to buy cable TV. They want you to subscribe on the internet, and they want you to buy the discs. They want to get paid three times for each thing you want to watch. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Tell you what. Let's go back to the phones. We got Bert from Palmyra. Go ahead, Bert. Bert.
Bert, are you there? Maybe we took too long.
No, Bert.
Well, try again, Bert. We'll try to get you on before the top of the hour. So, it's frustrating because I've been wanting to do that myself. You know, cable TV bills keep skyrocketing, and it would be really nice to be able to watch stuff on the internet. Most people have computers that you can connect to your television. Then there's the Apple TV and the Roku box where you connect the internet to your television. And more TVs these days have internet built in where you've got, say, a Netflix or Hulu app right on your television. Really nice to be able to watch those old TV shows or even shows that you missed. You know, you missed an episode of something this week. You can watch it online and don't have to wait for it to come back in reruns and remember which one you missed.
It's also a great use for your old Macintosh. You can hook that up to your computers, television. Yeah. And
let's try Bert again. Go ahead, Bert.
Maybe.
Bert?
He's on the phone, but he can't make it to the board.
Yeah, try one more time, Bert. I mean, we're putting him through the minute he's getting dropped. I don't know why. I'm doing what I normally do. Try one more time, Bert. We'll give you a shot. I don't know.
Yeah, very strange. But yeah, so online video. I don't really want to subscribe to Showtime at $30 a month or whatever it is. I just want to watch Dexter. Yeah. So at the end of the season, I can buy the Dexter season pack for that $30 or so. I don't want to wait. I want to watch it now.
Bert, you there now?
Try a different phone, Bert. Maybe is it your end or our end?
No, it says it's transferring it and transferring. I move it on over and it ain't happening.
Somewhere in the school, there's a phone ringing.
Oh, hold on a moment. Let me try something
Let's
else.
Let's figure that out. So, yeah, a lot of networks have come out with apps for the iPad. You were mentioning the ABC app earlier. ABC Video is available as an app, so you can watch a lot of ABC shows.
Oh, all the networks
NBC
do it.
NBC shows, yep.
CBS, Fox.
HBO has an app, but because HBO has agreements with cable television that sort of, you know, have been around for 20-odd years, then if you want to use the HBO app on your mobile device, on your iPad or on your Android device, you also have to be an HBO television subscriber. And that's the same sort of thing. I don't want to subscribe to HBO. I just want to watch True Blood or what's that other big show that was on? Walking Dead.
Uh-huh.
No, that was AMC. So, and that's part of the problem. People don't know what network their show is on. They just want the show. You know, I watch Big Bang Theory. I don't know what network it's on.
Yeah,
but sometimes I don't even
search
know what,
for where it is.
Right, sometimes I don't even know what channel it's on. But
yeah,
but yeah, I don't want to have to worry about that. I just want to watch the show.
That's right.
And with the cable companies wanting you to buy the cable TV subscription as well, that's it's just getting more and more expensive.
Bert,
yes,
there
all
right.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, what happened?
We had to reboot the computer.
Right? Yeah, I had to reboot this little box. I just noticed that the lights weren't coming on and. So, you're
no
back.
Problem. Great show as always, guys.
Thank you.
Question about partitioning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dual booting right now and would like to stick a third OS on. Was wondering which partitioning programming stuff you'd recommend.
What is the third OS you want to do?
you're not going to believe it. Haiku. It's an old, based on the old BOS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you know what partitioning software you're using now or dual booting software?
I'm using Linux Mint and Mepis, and they take care of it themselves. You know when you're
yeah, that's the easiest thing. This is
right.
This is a good question for Nick because he does this a lot. If the OS you're installing does its own partition tables
no.
and its own boot managers, the other thing you can do is get a second hard drive or a
I
third
was
hard drive.
Suggest
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Sometimes that's a little easier than messing with dual boots,
and it's a lot cheaper.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yep, just put another hard drive if your computer has the bay for it. Put another hard drive in, and then you can use your BIOS boot manager to choose which OS you want to boot from.
That would be a heck of a lot easier. You're right. Good idea.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes you have to weigh how much time is it going to take me to go through this process of partitioning everything and backing everything up before I do that and moving everything back and forth. And it can just make more sense to just buy another external hard drive.
Yeah.
Or the other thing.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah, you could use a virtual machine program. You could use Sun. What's Sun's free VirtualBox?
Their emulator.
Sun has a free virtualization program, and there's also commercial virtualization programs from Parallels and Fusion, or VMware, that give you a virtual machine inside of your current OS.
Hmm.
And that's really handy for playing with other OSs or just playing with a secure environment so that something can't get out of that virtual machine. It's just tied into that virtual machine.
The only downside of that is you have a bit of a drop in efficiency.
Yeah, since you're running a second OS inside your first OS, that you typically need double the RAM and extra hard drive and extra processor power to handle those two OSs simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
But it's a neat way to play with it.
Cool. Okay, doke. I think I'll be shopping for a hard drive.
There you go.
Already.
Have fun.
Thanks a lot.
Let us know how you make out.
Yeah, it's kind of neat being able to have multiple hard drives. In fact, VMware has multiple pre-built virtual machine files. So if you buy the VMware product, it's Fusion for the Mac and probably just VMware on Windows, you can download a pre-built Linux distribution and Red Hat distribution and Ubuntu distribution. So a lot of the free Linux OSs, you download a pre-built VM and it's already there for you.
If you go to Wikipedia, they have a wonderful list of all the emulators that are out there on the market. It's pretty comprehensive. I was very impressed with it.
Yep. Yeah, so a virtual machine allows you to mimic another computer, and then you can run different operating system in that other computer.
All right, yeah, if you want to just pick up a good used one, though. I mean, there's plenty of those.
Yeah, that's another option, too. Just pick up an old PC.
And do it like with a KVM switch. I mean, you can go get an older machine probably for $50 that'll run one of those systems because it's the advantage of these other systems. They don't need a heck of a lot of horsepower to do them. So these other machines that folks, won't handle, say, Windows 7, but yet it ran fine with, say, Windows XP, they could get that box, probably a lot cheaper and put it on their other operating systems and be tickled pink. And just like I say, use a KVM switch that you just hit the switch, and that way you only need one monitor, one keyboard, one mouse.
That's right, and you just switch between them.
Switch between the two.
Yeah, there's some...
Makes life a lot simpler.
A lot of high-end...
Pretty good management packages out there.
Yep. A lot of high-end servers. Nick has mentioned this at RIT. They have one giant server with tons of RAM and tons of processors, and they do everything in VMs. So you have a VM for your database, you have a VM for your email program, you have a VM for your calendar program, and those programs don't know any better. They're just running inside that VM. And it actually can save a lot on hardware costs because you don't need separate physical computers for that.
Yep. Okay, well, time always flies by when you're having so much fun like we do here every Saturday. But I want to thank you very much for all the folks that took the time to, you know, pick up the phone, give us a call, because it's been a lot of fun. And I want to thank both of you guys for coming in. You can jump in there and say goodbye for a moment. You know, and, you know, it just makes it go a lot easier when we got you folks and we can help you out so much. It makes what we do worthwhile. So I want, again, thank you for calling. And again, we'll be on here next Saturday. Again, same time, same station. So give us a call, save up your computer questions. And also, if you get a chance, shameless plug, I do a show on Thursday nights from 6 to 9. So if you wouldn't mind, give me a listen. Talk to you later. Have a good weekend, folks. And for Dave Enright and Soundbites, see you next week.
Here are the club calendar highlights.